Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know, the drill, we're recording on Thursday morning. I always open with something kind of quirky or interesting or sad, but I'm going to talk a little bit about Easter eggs. Yes, why am I talking about Easter eggs? Because I saw an article at Salon.com. Why chocolate prices are likely to skyrocket soon. As of last month, the world price for cocoa has more than doubled over last year. And here is the nugget from the article. You might want to stock up on chocolate for Easter pronto, because chocolate prices are likely bound to explode very soon. According to Food & Wine, cocoa prices are at a 47-year high. So what caused this? Inflation may play a part. But the bigger issue at hand is that cocoa cultivation in both Africa and specifically Ghana and the Ivory Coast and Ecuador has reportedly become much more complicated due to what? Shock. Climate change, as well as drier weather patterns and rainfall changes. In addition, there was a shortage of cocoa due to that unfavorable weather coupled with crop disease and smuggling in Ghana. The smuggling is thought to have accounted for approximately $600 million in lost revenue, as per the agency France Presse. So again, I'm trying to keep it real. I'm trying to keep it relevant. So if you're worried about your Easter eggs, figure out something else. That's all I have to say. And of course, the climate crisis is impacting absolutely everything around us. No one will escape it. Normally, we get Scott Braddock from the Quorum Report in Texas. But at the last minute, again, we were told that he was not able to grab us. But I was able to get John Nichols, the fabulous John Nichols, to join us. John Nichols is a national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He has written, co-written, and edited over a dozen books on topics ranging from histories of American socialism and the Democratic Party to analyses of U.S. and global media systems. His latest book was co-written with Bernie Sanders. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's entitled, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. Well, let me welcome you to the program, and angry about capitalism is what I've been all week, John Nichols. We're talking about Big Pharma with Lynn Paramore this week. We were talking about the economic messaging with Ro Khanna this week. Everything went back to how ticked off I am about capitalism. And then I was posting something, and I definitely want to get into what you want to talk about. But I posted something on Facebook, and it's been so interesting. I've been banging the drum about what's been going on with CEO compensation versus worker compensation. But this is the one that I thought was so interesting. The largest 200 U.S. public companies saw net profits soar to $1.25 trillion in 2022, a 63% increase since 2018. Now, with all those incredible profits, this is the part that made me furious, which is why it's okay to be angry at capitalism. 90% of those net profits was paid out to shareholders. 90%. So then the question is, who are the workers who are producing the profits, and where were they on the line to actually receive anything in the way of benefits? They were invisible. They were invisible. And so I thought about the book that you wrote with Bernie, every time you turn around and you look at what's happening to the American worker, you get so frustrated, John. And then last but not least, and then I want to get into what's going on with Gaza and Hamas concern for a ceasefire.
Let's talk about this for a little bit.
Oh, I absolutely, let me just read you one more thing, because this also sort of feeds into it. So I want to talk about CEO compensation. I want to talk about profits. I want to talk about shareholders. But my daughter has lived all over the world, and she finally moved back as an adult about 2 years ago with her only child from Shanghai. And she's just so appalled at how can we be a rich country and there be nothing in the way of safety and security for families and people raising children and all these things. And I posted this because in a lot of ways it flows from that first story I was just reading to you, the statistic. And I wrote this: does America hate families? In France, they have housing supplements, family allowances for more than two children, preschool for all, excellent free national health care, and now a constitution that protects the right to an abortion. A rich country doesn't set families up to fail, but the U.S. has perfected the art. Our motto is, you're on your own, Jack. Yes. And those two stories, I think, really go together and explain the frustration, the fear, the anxiety. It may be being played off by Donald Trump with no solutions But at the same time, there is legitimacy to this really, this sense of insecurity and fear about what tomorrow will bring.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, I wrote a piece last week about Biden's budget, which wasn't very, very much covered in a lot of the media, because, of course, it's not going to go anywhere, right?
Of
This
course.
is the president's put a budget out. And because we are now fully dysfunctional at the federal government level, I mean, we do not have what most countries would define as a functioning federal government, because in most countries in the world, of course, they have parliamentary democracy. So you elect a party, right, or its coalition, and then they govern, right? And they may have twists and turns and battles within, but they govern. In America, of course, because we have this disjointed system, the House of Representatives remains by one vote, basically, one or two, a barrier to anything Biden's going to do. But with that said, Biden's budget was, in many ways, one of the best budgets ever put out by a Democratic president.
Oh,
And the
wow.
reason for it was based almost entirely on taxing the rich and on increasing taxes on corporations to a legitimate level. Not Franklin Roosevelt or Dwight Eisenhower levels, mind you, not even Richard Nixon levels, but to a level that would actually begin to raise substantial revenues. And as Biden suggested, that would be used to maintain the social safety net, particularly maintaining Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, right? It's a good budget. And what I argued in the piece I wrote was that we know this isn't going to go anywhere this year, but this is what Biden and the Democrats should run on. And
Exactly.
but it's a big deal, because this is the thing. Biden has a terrible problem of proposing things that are good, right? And then, letting the balloon go up and then walking away and doing something else, right? This is one of those times where Biden and the Democrats, if they run on this, right? If they literally run on, yeah, if you elect us, we're going to tax the rich, we're going to tax corporations at a fair level, and we're going to go after profit sharing, all the things that you're talking about here. If
Right.
they ran on that, they've got the potential to actually win big, right? But if they don't emphasize it enough, then the energy will, on some of this, go to Trump, right?
But let me just stop you here, because not only do they have to emphasize it, not only do they have to talk about it, they have to talk about it ad nauseum over and over again.
That's what
Because
I'm
when you
saying.
turn on CNN, when you turn on MSNBC, it's all Trump. It's all about, can he raise the 450 million? It's all about the delay. It's all about the Supreme Court. It's all about, what's happening at the border. And so their message, even if they, as you point up, they throw up the trial balloon and then that's it. Well, what they have to learn to do is what Rush Limbaugh did. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, he repeated, he repeated, he repeated, he repeated, and he ultimately became the talking points for virtually the entire conservative
However,
country.
there's
What?
one subtlety to this, right?
Okay. Okay.
Rush Limbaugh was wrong.
Oh
Yeah, I mean,
no,
this is,
that's my point. Rush
yeah.
Limbaugh was consistent and wrong. Democrats are inconsistent and right. I had a big fight once with E.J. Dionne, okay? And we were fighting about public radio. And E.J. Dionne would say, "Isn't public radio wonderful? Isn't it wonderful?" I said, "No, it's not." I said, "Because they tell a story once and that's the end of it." I said, "Here's the difference. They tell the story once with the facts and the documentation, the supporting information, and then the story disappears. Rush Limbaugh, as I just pointed out, is on 3 hours a day telling the lie. 3 hours a day, giving it the idea that somehow there are facts that support it, which there never were." I said, "So here you have what you are applauding as, isn't this wonderful? But it is not a counterweight to 3 hours a day of misinformation, lies, and distortion 5 days a week." And so, in a lot of ways, it's so funny that NPR we so love, but what we lost by having any access to commercial radio, where you're able to be on for hours at a time and have conversations like this, that's why the Democrats have to learn. You may not get MS. NBC to talk about it unless you talk about it ad nauseum.
Well, and so this gets to the point, and it's actually something, Senator Sanders and I have a chapter of this on the book, and which is, basically our core theme is billionaires should not exist,
Yeah, me
and
too.
they're a policy failure in and of themselves. And but here's the interesting thing about it. Another thing that the senator and I've talked a lot about in the book and other settings is how you deal with the media.
Yeah.
And And what he always emphasizes is that he's on media a lot now because he's a reasonably, you know, I mean, he ran for president a couple of times. People are interested. So he does a lot of media. And often he's invited on to gossip, right? Because that's what most media is, right? It's gossip, right? It's yes, a conversation yes. about, oh, yeah, what do we think about Trump today? And he says that often he has to force a conversation toward, you know, that which actually matters, right? You know, to say, yeah, that's true. It's very important, blah, blah, blah. Now, let's talk about this economic issue, healthcare, education. And I think that's sort of what Democrats have to do. And whether they're capable of it, I don't know. But what I'll tell you is this, that you know, if you're asked about, you know, any number of things, right? Let's say you're asked about Trump. Say Trump is very dangerous, right? He shouldn't be president. And one of the reasons he shouldn't be president is that when he was president, they cut taxes for the rich, right? And they cut taxes for corporations.
Bingo.
So then you take it in and then you make the conversation there. Now, the subtlety of this is that, of course, you don't avoid, you know, breaking news. It really matters. But so much of our media now is on a kind of a repeat loop. You know what I mean? Yes. It's just the same thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
And it's become so bad that we actually have a void in America for honest discussion about economics. We don't do it. And so anyways, this is the piece I wrote. And one of the things that I emphasized in it, which I think is relevant to Biden, because Biden fancies himself as the most liberal or progressive president since Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. That's not actually true. He hasn't beaten Lyndon Johnson yet. And he may not even have beaten Dwight Eisenhower. Or Harry Truman. But the bottom line is he fancies himself this, which is great, right? It's an aspiration. Well, okay, if your aspiration is to be like FDR, then you really ought to study how FDR won the largest landslide in history for his second term, right? And it wasn't in good times. It was there was still a Great Depression. FDR had been president for the better part of 4 years. And while he had done a lot to ease the pain, the reality was that America was still very much in the Great Depression. Yeah. And so if you imagined it in our current circumstance, right, what would what would Alf Landon have been saying? You know, and the Republicans said, FDR has been president for 4 years and things are worse than ever. You know, well, that wouldn't be true, but that's what they'd be saying. And they might be getting traction with it. Right. But FDR said two things. Number one, I know you're still in pain.
Yeah.
I know we haven't solved every problem.
That's what I want Biden
have
to say.
We met the challenge, but I know you're still in pain. But let me tell you why so many of these powerful interests are opposed to me getting a second term. Because we've done a lot in the first term. If I get a second term, we can close the deal. We can actually make it happen for working class Americans. And then,
I agree.
But what was his key line? Of course, his key line given on October 31st at Madison Square Garden, the last great rally before the 1936 election.
Chicken in every pot?
No.
What was his great line?
That was Al Smith. That was a great line.
Okay.
But and even the Republicans sometimes said that in those days as well. but no, think of this one. Roosevelt got up and he said, the bankers are against me. The CEOs are against me.
Right.
Concentrated economic power is against me. And I welcome their hatred.
Yes, I love
you. What an incredible message, right?
This incredible message
was there all these people that are built up in a lot of the media that you see as, you know, the experts on economics, they're the ones who took you into the Great Depression.
Right.
And now they don't want me to help you get out of it.
Right.
And so it was this very, it was a combative message coming from a sitting president who, by the way, was not in the greatest of health and was portrayed, you know, as you know, sometimes portrayed and criticized as not as active as his Republican opponent. You do all the blah, blah, blah. He cut through all of that. And he said, you know, look, this is a fight. I'm on one side. I'm on your side.
Right.
And the famous line.
Brilliant.
There was a famous line from that election. Roosevelt went by, and there's a reporter talking to somebody on the bylines or on the, you know, sidelines. Roosevelt goes by and somebody is just like, you know, like really cheering and just so vibrant, tears in the eyes, some working class guy. And the reporter said something like, wow, it seems like you know the president. Do you know the president? And the guy said, no, I don't know him, but he knows me.
Oh, you've told me that story before. It makes me cry every time. And you know what I'm thinking as I'm listening to you talking? So I heard Bernie the other day talking about the 32-hour work week and that they should be paid for as if they were working 40, but they should be working 32. The reason I even mention that is, again, the idea that Bernie is always bringing it back and connecting the dots. That goes directly to what the statistic I just read you. The largest 200 U.S. public companies saw net profits soar to $1.25 trillion, 63% increase, 90% was paid out to shareholders. So you know what? We know they got the profits. We know who actually produced the profits. So rather than giving 90% to shareholders, they could have said, okay, we're going to pay you for a 40-hour work week, but you only have to work 32. We know they have the cash because where did the money go? Not to workers, but to shareholders. And again, to connect the dots, we know they can do it because we know they have the cash, but where is it going?
That's exactly right. And see,
this is
what we're talking about here is really important, right? I think This is where we get to the heart of the matter is that, you know, when you have an intense discussion about economics, not a casual discussion, but an intense one, and we've had it a few times in this country. By the way, I want to clarify because we were, you know, kind of like floating around there on chicken in every pot.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to tell you, that was initially Herbert Hoover and the Republicans saying that, right?
Okay.
But this is why it's important, okay? This is why it's important because you do associate it sometimes, you know, we associate it with Democrats and, but it was Herbert Hoover and the Republicans who said it in the 1920s. And then in the 1930s, as the Great Depression hit, right, the Democrats came back and said, you know, they promised you all this stuff. They promised you, you know, chicken in every pot, car in every garage, all this good stuff. And you got a Great Depression out of it. Right. And Roosevelt didn't just say that in 1932 when he was running against Hoover, or the Democrats didn't just say that. They kept saying it in 1936 and 1940 and 1944. You know, they kept bringing it back to, you know, those broken promises of the Republicans. Why this matters is that the way to run against Trump, there are many ways to run against Trump, right? You talk about his threat to democracy and things like that. That's legitimate. But what you have to understand is, the guy's a very good communicator. He's a brilliant communicator. And what he communicated when he ran for president in 2016 was that he was going to take care of the working class, right? Whether you like it or not, that was his message. Well, in the context of everything we're discussing here, how did he take care of the working class? He cut taxes for billionaires at a record rate. He cut taxes regulation on corporations. He tipped the balance more toward the wealthy, more toward elites. And then when we got hit with a pandemic, right? It was a horrible, horrible challenge. Instead of saying, look, we're going to do what Roosevelt did in the Depression and in World War II, which is we're going to tax the rich on all their excess profits, right? We're going to just, you know, we're not going to tax them out of existence, but we're going to tax their excess profits, the wealthy and corporations. Instead of doing that, no, he continued his deep tax cuts for the wealthy, for corporations. And so here's this great narrative that the Democrats can produce. And it is very parallel to what Roosevelt did. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I don't believe that Joe Biden has achieved, you know, best since Roosevelt status yet, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a great aspiration. So why not try?
This economic message that he's so frustrated with. Ro Khanna was on with us this week, John, and he said that someone said that the problem with Joe Biden is that he's been building cathedrals and referring to the infrastructure and the manufacturing facilities, but that ultimately what people really need is they need to be able to afford their drugs, afford the doctor, afford the house, make sure that they can afford the daycare. Those are the sort of micro basic things they want. And I was looking at an article because we were talking with Lynn Paramore about Big Pharma, and Big Pharma is like apoplectic about the idea that we might negotiate drugs, okay, the price of drugs. So I think, again, I want to go back to what you said, that what Joe Biden should say is, you know who I'm for by the people who hate me. All right. And so, for example, Big Pharma hates me. But what was so amazing about this article I read is that there are lawyers that are now in court basically trying to argue against negotiating the price of drugs, because they're going to say, oh, we can't do our research and development. Oh, it's going to impair our ability to actually operate as pharmaceutical companies. And then I'm reading this article that said that the CEOs of all these major pharmaceutical companies are talking to anxious shareholders, and they are reassuring them that the impact of the negotiations on pricing would be modest and that would not affect their ability to produce profits. So think about this. These are the same companies. Their lawyers are attacking the feds for trying to negotiate prices, claiming A, and then they're talking to their shareholders and saying, it won't be a big deal. We'll be fine. Yep. I mean, that to me is a story that needs a billboard, because in the end, if it's going to be modest and you can survive it, then we absolutely have to make sure that they're affordable to the American people.
Sure. And so let's go back then. Let's use that as our example. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go back then, because, inflation is a real issue, right?
Yes.
It's not to be dismissed. But one of the reasons why prices are so high is that corporations have been price gouging. We know that to be the case. So then let's go back to our reference before to chicken in every pot. Right?
Right.
Chicken in every pot in the 20s was actually at the heart of it, it's Hoover's reelect campaign. But Hoover wasn't talking about that so much. It wasn't his big slogan. It was actually an ad that was put out by Republican business people. And Hoover was saying that Republicans were the party of prosperity, right?
Right.
And that these Republican business people, they did these ads that said chicken in every pot, and it's kind of trying to portray an image of prosperity. So then here you've got a situation where back in 2016, if you go back to when Trump was running for president, you find plenty of clips of him saying, oh yeah, we're gonna get those drug prices down. We're gonna, negotiate with them. I'm the great negotiator, stuff like
right,
that.
Right. Yes, of course.
You take that clip, right? And then you look at where they are today, right? And you look at what Biden's trying to do to actually take them down. But you emphasize that Trump didn't do that, right? He did not. To negotiate them down. He didn't actually solve the problem. And so then again, here you are in a case. That's what Democrats did, by the way, in 1932, 1936. They kept going back to saying, this is what they promised you. This is what they didn't do. Now here's what we are going to do, what we are doing, what we're going to do.
Right.
So it's not a complicated narrative, right? It's one that people can understand. It's essentially, they lied to you. Don't trust them. Don't give them power back, right? You know what I mean? Simple concept. And could you do that on pharmaceutical? Absolutely.
And you can actually quote the CEOs talking to the shareholders saying, we can handle this. Really?
And you can quote the Republicans talking about it, right? And so the bottom line is that when you do politics, right? And look, I got to be honest with you. I love covering politics. I like to write about it, right? I can think of scenarios where Republicans can be their best selves and write and have their best campaigns. I can think of scenarios where Democrats can. When we talk about these things, it's possible to see how it's done. And what shocks me is that in this circumstance, really, as the economy started to take off, Democrats didn't seize control of the narrative.
No.
Right? They haven't. And they've been scattered in many different directions. The key to this is that to say, look, again, it's that sort of two-step honesty. First, you say, look, it's not where it should be. I understand you're still hurting, right?
Right.
So, but here's how we've made things a lot better. And here's how we need a second term with a Senate and a House, and how dramatically better we can make things, right? You know what I mean? It's just, you look at this, and here's the best example. If I was Biden, right? Which I'll never be. But let's say if you're Biden and you say, look, today or yesterday, stock market just hit record highs, record highs. And a lot of Americans are invested in the stock market. Also, a lot of our media uses the stock market as a measure of our prosperity. If I'm Biden, I say, look, that's a part of prosperity, right?
Exactly.
And it's clear that there's evidence that this economy is doing well. But real prosperity is universal. Right. Real prosperity has to be felt by everybody, not just people that have a 401k, people that have investments in stocks. And so I don't want to take away that prosperity, right, from those who are, enjoying it. What I do want to do is make sure that those who haven't gotten their piece of the action get it. Right.
Right.
And the way to do that is fair taxation, right? Fair and honest, progressive taxation, so that especially people that aren't even contributing, right? You know, just inheritance taxes, things like that. There's a lot you can do to raise a lot of revenues. And that raising of the revenues is used to do what? To strengthen our social safety net in America, to make sure that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid are functional, strong, and to make sure that our education programs are strong, our healthcare programs are strong, our rural infrastructure programs are strong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're Biden, what you say is, we do that and the stock market will continue to go up.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll be able to measure another, have another measure of economic prosperity. And that is that Main Street, far from Wall Street, will also go up. Because when Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and all these programs are working, that's good for Main Street.
And on that note, John Nichols, thank you so much for joining us. He is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. He's written and co-written a dozen books on so many topics, but his most recent one is the one that makes me smile. It was co-written with Bernie Sanders. It's okay to be angry at capitalism. And on this show, you know that I'm pretty ticked off. Anyway, thank you so much for doing this, John. I really appreciate it. This, everyone, is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. It has now been almost 9 years since Donald Trump came down that golden escalator and began his campaign in 2016. I don't know who's going to win this year's election. It could be Trump. I certainly hope it isn't. But even if Biden wins, Trump isn't exactly going to go away. The MAGA movement, Trump himself, and the cult will definitely go on. And the reason I say this, the reason I stress this, is because since Trump got elected, so to speak, president, and since he went into the White House, so much of the concern about Trump has been focused implicitly on how do we roll this back? How do we get back to where we were? But after a decade of this, there is no getting back to where we were. If we want to create or save American democracy, we have to be forward-looking. It doesn't mean we have to abandon everything about pre-Trump American political institutions, but it means we must begin to look beyond them. The answer to the problem of Trump and the answer to the question of how to make American democracy stronger than Trump does not lie exclusively or perhaps even largely in the pre-Trump world.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality. For so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war. Where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Attic.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We continue to record on Thursday morning. If it is Friday, it must be Bill Curry. Bill Curry is an American lawyer and politician. He's been a two-time Democratic nominee for the governorship of Connecticut, a White House advisor in the administration of Bill Clinton, and he was the head of Freeze Voter, a nuclear freeze group. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Curry.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And we've never, I think, mixed the two of you up, but we've had Rick on quite often on our Friday show. Rick Newman is a former New Hampshire state representative, a Portsmouth city councilor. He has over 41 years of experience in New Hampshire state government. He's an established figure lobbying on behalf of both local and national companies and was originally born, I believe, in Canada. Am I correct, Mr. Newman?
Well, Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. Oh, that's Canada. You're such a jerk. Yes, Newfoundland. I know. And you drove a cab. I mean, there's so much about you that I love. So it's like, I want to make sure everybody gets the full, complete picture. So gentlemen, I sent you a list of topics, but there was an article I read this morning at Salon.com that really, in some ways, I want to begin with, and I forgive me for not forwarding it to you, but I'm going to pull out the two strategic paragraphs in this piece because it speaks to more than what's going on with the Supreme Court in Texas. It really speaks volumes about, I think, the issues going forward. And the title of Amanda Marcotte's piece was Supreme Court grants Governor Greg Abbott's wish to turn Texas into a far-right dictatorship. All right, that's the headline. So let me just read you the two, I think, operative paragraphs in this really fabulous piece by Amanda. Late last week, the Supreme Court allowed West Texas A&M University to proceed with its ban of drag shows hosted by on-campus groups, even though the school's censorship violates decades of First Amendment precedents. This week, the Supreme Court did it again, allowing Texas to temporarily go forward with a clearly unconstitutional claim that state law supersedes federal jurisdiction when it comes to immigration. Neither decision constitutes the final word on whether Texas can flout the constitutional order so openly, to be clear. But even letting it get this far represents Supreme Court's eagerness to bless Governor Greg Abbott, the Republican of Texas, in his quest to turn his state into a far-right dictatorship. But then Amanda ends this way, gentlemen. Even if the drag ban and immigration law are eventually overturned, all this legal maneuvering sends a signal to Texas and red states. The Supreme Court is sympathetic to their white nationalist and theocratic impulses. Even when they can't, by law, uphold the authoritarian yearnings of Republican state leaders, they will do everything they can to help those politicians grasp as much power as possible. This also suggests, as with Dobbs, that the court will stretch the definition of constitutional to its breaking point to allow Republicans to attack basic human rights, which means we may be seeing states take up Thomas's invitation to revisit whether birth control or same-sex relations are human rights sooner rather than later. William, I read Amanda's piece, and we lost Scott Braddock, who we normally grab at the very beginning of the show. And yet this story is not a story just about Texas. It is really a story about what the Supreme Court is doing to aid and abet all the MAGA governors. And the story about, for example, the immigration law that Governor Abbott got passed and now is being questioned is that the governor of Iowa has introduced the same legislation. We're going to see this like whack-a-mole coming up everywhere, that every state is going to basically replicate, all the MAGA states are going to replicate exactly what Governor Abbott is intending to do. And there's a bit of an irony here because you may have heard me say this ad nauseum, but it's not just about migrants coming across the border. It's the 11 million that live here now that are here undocumented. All right. And I keep saying over and over again, just in Houston, Texas alone, there are 600,000 undocumented immigrants. If you go to any meatpacking plant, if you go to any farm in California or Texas or anywhere, you will find so many undocumented immigrants are doing the labor and the work that's necessary to put food on our table. And look what these laws are doing. And as Stephanie said, you can't be brown and live in Texas anymore because you know that by profiling, you will be stopped. And talk about the fear of living. It's the whole thing is just so horrific. But when I saw what Amanda wrote, I wanted to begin here because the 2024 election is so crucial, but I am so terrified because everything is now getting in the way of a potential success of what I think ultimately the American electorate wants. But it's not that Biden will lose. It's that Arnie will lose. It's that Bill will lose. And that's really what this feels like. I feel like every single stop sign is being put up as we approach November. And then to read this about Texas and what the court did, I'm terrified, Bill. I'm terrified.
The judiciary has become more terrifying in its entirety. Yeah. And an idea that I've clung to in the last few years is that the corruption and subversion of the judiciary, however fast the pace of it was during those four Trump years, overall has not kept pace with the corruption and subversion of the democracy, and that we still, that the democracy might be saved by the judiciary. Trump, if found guilty of felonies, I still believe would not be elected. Clearly, the judiciary won't move in time. Trump, to my mind, based upon everything I've ever learned about constitutional law, is ineligible to be president. When the Supreme Court ruled that allowing Colorado to kick him off the ballot, or simply setting the standard for all 50 states would unleash chaos, they basically rescinded the 14th Amendment.
Exactly.
Stunningly. And of course, they said, as MAGA fascist Republicans do, the opposite of the truth. They said that setting the standard now would create chaos because all 50 states could be making applications, when in fact, that all 50 states would be bringing the applications to the only place where chaos could be avoided, the Supreme Court, which would exactly what Colorado was doing in the case. No, there is a single place to set a single standard, and you're it, and the law is clear. And they simply sidestepped all of it. In this case, the very first thing you learn in constitutional law, week one, someone brings up preemption and the supremacy of federal law. And it's like, you know, suddenly John Calhoun and the nullification crowd are back in the driver's seat. By the way, with great discrimination on the issues they wish to overthrow. They're for states' rights when the state issue state policy is on their side, and they're for federal preemption when the federal policy is on their side. There's no consistency in these people, and so I look at what's happening with this, and you know, you want to talk about chaos as they did in the Colorado case. Imagine all 50 states having their own immigration policies.
Exactly. They're inviting chaos.
It's completely absurd. It's completely absurd and has no grounding in the law. And so I've reached the point where we all reached about the third day of the Trump presidency of realizing about the judiciary that it is no longer a place where we can expect, in the federal judiciary in particular, but it's rampant at every level, we can no longer expect and count on a fair day in court, that a fair jury of our peers, a right to the presumption of innocence, all the fundamental tenets built into our culture of our expectations of the judiciary and all of our expectations of its protection of the other basic institutions of government. I am left with no faith whatsoever. I am crushed by what we've watched this year.
So, Rick, both of us are from New Hampshire, and we know that Governor Sununu went down to the border to sort of hang out with Governor Abbott. And there was about 12 Republican governors that went there to support Abbott in what he's attempting to do. So this isn't a Texas story. This is a New Hampshire story. Because you know that if it's going to be introduced in Iowa, it's going to be introduced in New Hampshire. And if it's going to be introduced in New Hampshire, it's going to be introduced in Florida. If it's, you know, I mean, we know that it's this growing faster ball that's going to be moving downhill. And again, I just want to go and read these three headlines because they really sort of encapsulate the incredible fear here, the one that I mentioned with Amanda Marcotte. Supreme Court grants Governor Greg Abbott's wish to turn Texas into a far-right dictatorship. Donald Trump isn't the only far-right character the Supreme Court could bless with dictatorial powers. That was the Salon article. Let me read you the Slate headline. The Supreme Court just gave Texas a green light to harass every Latino person in the state. Let me read you the third headline. Inspired by Texas, Republicans in other states eye immigration bills. Iowa lawmakers passed a similar bill on Tuesday, and several other states are hoping to follow suit. Look what we are doing. We keep waiting to say, you know, Donald Trump is talking about rounding up all the undocumented, okay? We don't have to wait for 2024. We just are giving license now to all these Republican governors to start rounding them up now, to start rounding them up now. And as you just heard from Bill, well, the concept of preemption just went out the window, and we've seen it go out the window on so many other occasions. There is no law of the land. Now there's just basically fear, depending on which state you land in. And frankly, that fear isn't just going to apply to that state, because you and I both know you might live in Vermont, but you might work in New Hampshire. Well, what happens if you happen to be Latino and you live in Vermont and you move to New Hampshire and we pass something identical to what they're just doing now in places like Iowa and Texas? I mean, this isn't just about where you live. It will now infiltrate all of us.
Well, to pick up on what Bill was talking about, the inconsistency, I mean, one case comes to mind. It seems to me recently, in the last year at least, the Supreme Court struck down a New York law about gun permitting, permits yes. for carrying handguns. And I remember thinking at the time, isn't that interesting? Because they're talking about the federal constitution and federal preemption. But here they're going in the opposite direction and saying, oh, no, it's OK. You can violate people's rights because the state of Texas wants to. As he said, they pick and choose when preemption comes in and when federal protection comes in and it doesn't. You pointed out at the beginning, we joked about the fact that I was born in Newfoundland. If I'm walking down the street in Houston, I'm an immigrant. And if there's a fellow walking down next to me who's happens to look brown or Latino, who's also an immigrant, we both are legal immigrants, one of us is probably going to get pulled over and asked to show their papers. It's yes. not likely to be me.
Yes.
And that's exactly what this case sets up. No probable cause. And I'd like to ask people listening, how many of you are walking around with proof that you're a legal citizen of the United States? I mean, I don't think anybody is. You might have a driver's license, but that doesn't mean anything. I mean, who's walking around with their birth certificate? Who's walking around with their passport or their documentation that they were became citizens? I mean, no one is. And so who among us are going to be the ones that suffer potentially being detained illegally while we call up and get someone to come down to the courthouse with our documents? It's not going to be people that look like you and I, Arnie. It's going to be people that are right. That look like Latinos.
So this story about the Supreme Court is one thing. And then I go to the very first article from Slate.com that I suggested to you guys, keeping up with the Trump trials. So those delay tactics really worked. Who knows when the former president will face trial for any of the criminal charges he faces. So mañana, delay, deny. Trump is brilliant. He doesn't want to win. He doesn't care about winning. All he cares about is making sure he can run out the clock, run out the clock. And the scary thing about the amount of money that he owes the state of New York, or he has to actually come up with the $450 million, you know, everyone keeps saying, you know, like, who can he make a deal with? What can he sell? I know what he can sell. He can sell the White House. That's really what he's going to market. He's not going to market anything he owns yet. But since he's figuring this out and looking at all the polls and looking at what's happening, he knows exactly what he's going to sell. And it doesn't happen to be a Trump Tower, but it happens to be inside the Beltway. And that's the huge fear here, is that this is once again the court system working to his advantage and not to protecting us.
We had a great trial attorney in Connecticut, a friend of mine who's since passed, Hubie Santos, a really good criminal defense lawyer, but also just famous for his ability to stretch a trial out. I mean, you think that a client walks into his office and his first question is, what's your life expectancy? You know, because he'll keep that trial going for as long as the actuarial tables say you're going to be here anyway. And in some ways, we had a kind of, we sort of admired Hubie for having developed this particular skill. Yeah. And now we've had the, you know, now the whole system operates like Hubie used to have to force it to operate. You know, the justice denied, justice delayed equation has never been truer. Think of the Donald Trump audit that the IRS is now in at least year 16 of. And because it has no one really assigned to it, because there are, clearly aren't enough people to go through all the papers, so it will never be done. Right. And then think about how many other people just like him there must be in the IRS. So tax fraud automatically, it never even gets to court. Right. All that tax fraud just never even gets prosecuted. When you look at what Merrick Garland did, that you could be as steeped in the problems and the culture of this judiciary and sit down to a case as important as the subversion and possibly even termination of American democracy and not realize that the Justice Department had to go on, you know, warp speed and instead to have sat for 2.5 years doing nothing about this while you were weighing the politics of it, something that you weren't trained to do at law school and have no experience in anyway. And just watching our tolerance for this, all of these cases crawling like caterpillars. My heart is broken. It is a critical part of the necessary institutional reform that this country must undertake. To go through these judicial laws, to go through these possibilities for delay, and really tighten this up. This is an absolute assault on justice itself, and the legal system now tolerates it every day.
It's a distraction from the kind of messaging that Joe Biden so desperately wants to do. So now he's got to do this. You know what's going on with Abbott at the border. What's going on with this. Immigration policy and the concept of preemption, as Bill just said, is being thrown out the window. And now we're seeing states all over the country doing it. We just saw, I don't know if you saw this, but one of our candidates for governor in the state of New Hampshire was on Howie Carr yesterday. Okay. I remember we're taping this on Thursday. And what was she on Howie Carr talking about? She was talking about the fact that one of the Democratic candidates for governor refused to denounce the governor of Massachusetts. It's Maura Healey, who is not condemning sanctuary policies. I mean, so we have the New Hampshire governor being, you know, candidate for governor on with Howie Carr because she's supposed to comment on what the governor of Massachusetts is doing as if it applies to what we are doing, as if, and again, what does it all go back to? But the conversation about undocumented immigrants and immigration, instead of talking about what's happening with the economy, what's happening with CEO compensation, what's happening with the climate crisis, what's happening with the cost of drugs, what's happening with, you know, student loan debt. Everything is a distraction. And the two distractions are what's happening at the border and Donald Trump and the legal system that is aiding and abetting him and the Supreme Court. I mean, I feel like nothing matters. Everything is about a distraction, and there is no way going into 2024 that Joe Biden or the Democratic Party can have a real conversation with the American people, because there's no time in the media to even bring it up. Because if you watch MSNBC or you watch CNN, literally of the 24 hours, 22 hours is devoted to that, and none of it is devoting to the real issues that make a difference in people's lives. We don't ever get to talk about that.
Well, and obviously that's by design on the part of the Trump, but look at his co-conspirators. I mean, right down to this most recent delay in the New York criminal trial. And why is it delayed? Because the United States Attorney's Office dragged their feet to produce documents that were asked for by the Trump people. And the Trump people kept saying, sure, you can have a delay. You can have a delay, because it was to their advantage.
Yes. And
so the U.S. Attorney's Office played right into their hands. Okay. And my suspicion is that the reason that Bragg in that case agreed to a delay is because he also got late documents, and there may be some more, evidence in there against Trump, and he wants to use it. And maybe a year or two or three from now, or as Bill said, if, you know, assuming he lives that long, they'll have evidence that will lead to a conviction. But in the meantime, there's absolutely no downside in the criminal justice system for a guy like Donald Trump, because number one, he's not even paying his own legal bills. He's using the welfare checks of people from Alabama and Mississippi to pay his legal bills. I mean, and look at, just go back to Texas. The current attorney general in Texas has been under indictment since 2015. This is 2024. He's yet to come to trial. This is their playbook. And somehow I have a feeling that Latino person in Texas, were they to be indicted for something, would go to trial sometime between now and 9 years from now. They would not be able to drag their case out the way Paxton has or the way Trump is.
I'm going to end on sort of a quirky note, Bill Curry, because there was an article out of Newsweek, and I just think this is so interesting, because you know how everything is all about the Second Amendment as well. Okay, so there's nothing that we can do to be able to control the flow of guns, and the NRA controls every conversation. But this is where it's going to be very interesting to see how the Republicans are going to respond. Undocumented immigrants have right to own guns, judge rules. All right. Now, this is going to be, I mean, I feel like, again, it's kind of like, where's the consistency here? A judge this month dropped gun charges against an illegal migrant in Illinois, sparking further debate about the rights associated with the Second Amendment. U.S. District Court Judge Shannon Coleman of North District of Illinois referenced lower court judge rulings in dismissing the firearm possession charges against Herberto, who was illegally or unlawfully in the United States when he possessed a handgun in this village. I mean, I'm looking at the Dobbs decision and IVF. I'm looking at their embrace of the Second Amendment, and they're going to round up all those undocumented immigrants. But now we have a court saying, but that undocumented immigrant could obviously have a gun. I mean, it's like, look where we are. We are in complete and total chaos, Bill. That's what defines these next couple of months. If it was chaotic during the pandemic, that was a walk in the park. That was normal. This is what chaos looks like, because I don't see anything that looks like a safe ground. Everything makes no sense, and there is no consistency in the law, because I'm not even sure who's following the law.
Well, of course, this could be the beginning of a whole new era of the courts recognizing immigrant rights. No.
It could be.
They finally found one, the right to bear arms.
Right.
As long as we're on the subject. By the way, we're supposed to be so worried about violent immigrants, okay? These criminals, the awful immigrants come across the border. So let's arm them, okay?
Yes.
You know, anybody see a contradiction between these two approaches? You think just what up until 60 or 70 years ago, no one thought that the Second Amendment created any of the rights that are now imputed to it. It wasn't ever written in an article. We went 150 years after the Constitution before anyone even suggested it. And now it's part of what we believe. When I look at this court actually considering immunity for presidential action, probably, I hope, just a delay tactic, but considering immunity, trafficking in nullification, trafficking in the end of preemption, when I see what's happening right now, and I think back to the Second Amendment, I think, wow, any one of these things could be legitimized in this culture in the same way the Second Amendment argument was. These are now the core concepts of the Constitution. We were right at the judicial review since John Marshall. I mean, everything now is on the table by people whose only guiding star is their own rancid, rigid ideology, which they dress up occasionally in constitutional language in order to perpetuate the injustices that are dearest to their hearts. That's so much of the judiciary is like that right now. It is as the judiciary is in as much crisis as the overall democracy.
And I started by reading from Amanda Marcotte's amazing piece. I'm going to end by reading again the last two sentences, because it is an exclamation point since we're talking about the courts. The Supreme Court is sympathetic to their white nationalist and theocratic impulses, even when they can't, by law, uphold the authoritarian yearnings of Republican state leaders. They will do everything they can to help those politicians grasp as much power as possible. This also suggests, as with Dobbs, that the court will stretch the definition of constitutional to its breaking point to allow Republicans to attack basic human rights, which means we may be seeing states take up Thomas's invitation to revisit whether birth control or same-sex relations are human rights sooner rather than later. Look where we go. We start at the border and we end with these rights. Let me thank Bill Curry and Rick Newman so much for joining us. This, everyone, is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze on Monday. Ciao. You Just